Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Good morning, folks. It's Saturday, and this is On the Right Side. I am Reed Lance Rosenthal. Welcome aboard once again. And hello to all you new listeners out there in radio land and internet land. All right, I'm going to get right into it so I don't overrun my stay, which I often do, to the chagrin of the radio stations. Here's what we're going to be covering today. Number one, we're going to start off with a few kind of interesting tidbits. I'm not sure I can call them fun. Number one, I'm going to break down the national debt and the unfunded liability debt for you and tell you how much you, not all of us, just you, what's your portion of that debt? Oh boy, you're going to be so happy, and your kids are going to not be happy with you at all. Nope, your kids are going to be really upset that you've been at the sleep of their financial fiscal switch, so we say. I promised you a couple weeks ago and all sorts of things interceded and I wasn't able to get to it with all the news that I was going to give you this theory. I was going to tell you about this theory that skyscrapers, the construction of skyscrapers, are actually one of the best indicators of whether or not the economy is going in the tank or it isn't. I'm not saying I ascribe to this theory, but nonetheless, it is a theory. Nonetheless, it does have actually a pretty significant basis in fact and correlation, and I think you might even get a little smile out of it, kind of. Then I'm going to tell you a couple little tidbits about Barry and gun control, and it's going to be very brief, and you'll groan when you hear it as I groaned when I read it. I mean, it's just one more thing. This guy is just so bad. He is so bad. I'm going to give you a couple little comments on the race. You know, I made my prognostications in New Hampshire. I was right on. I was slightly off. Well, a little bit more than slightly off. I had the positions of two candidates juxtaposed in Iowa. Kind of had the order right, but the deal juxtaposed. New Hampshire right on. I'm going to give you my prognostications about South Carolina today. The polls are open as I speak down there, and people are casting ballots in the Republican primary. It's been kind of a crazy week on that. But most importantly today, and I mean this is going to be two-thirds of the show, we're going to talk about Justice Anthony Scalia. We're going to talk about the cases that are out there right now that may be affected by his death this year. We're going to talk about the arguments back and forth over appointing a ninth judge during Barry's term, which ends hopefully and thankfully in 10 months. And I'm going to give you some dots on the chessboard out there. This is a huge chessboard, folks. I mean, your rights are at stake. Your guns are at stake. Your money is at stake. Your free speech is at stake. Your religious freedom is at stake. Make no doubt about this. I can't underline this enough. The fate of America as we know her hangs in the balance of who appoints this next justice. And I'm gonna go into not only the factual stuff, I'm gonna give you some thoughts on this is three-dimensional political chess for the highest stakes imaginable, your security, your freedom, your family's financial safety. I mean, I can't emphasize this enough. But there's some interesting plays. There's some interesting moves that can be made on this political chessboard. And I have not heard them talked about anywhere. I'm going to try and bring those to your attention so that you can think about, you can think about it. You know, what ifs, particularly relative to what might else be happening with this court in the next 4 or 5 years, and who is going to be in power to make those appointments, and what the role of the Senate's going to be. I think you'll come away from this, literally most of the show, with a better understanding of the Supreme Court, a better understanding of what's been impacted right now, this moment, pending cases, including cases, by the way, that were voted on that will now be thrown out, so to speak. I'll explain that in a moment. And the cases that are upcoming. And then I'm going to go into a darker corner, because I don't think Anthony Scalia's death was accident at all. You know, there are no coincidences. And when you understand the rulings that came down and the opinions that he wrote just in the last month, and what the docket of the court is right now, and the cases which are pending, I mean, he was writing the decisions that now basically get thrown out. His vote gets thrown out. I think you'll come to the realization that I must say I had the moment I heard about his death, even before all the squirrely details, which I'm going to recount for you here. I mean, you've heard bits and pieces here and there. I'm going to put them all together, bullet point by bullet point. You can make your own decision. Maybe you think I'm crazy. Maybe you think I'm way out there. Maybe you think I've finally gone over the deep end in my cynical estimation of exactly what this government under this particular administration and under progressive control is capable of doing. And maybe you won't. But you need to know, and that's my job. So let's get started first, shall we? Okay, so the skyscraper theory. Let's start with that. It's kind of nice and light, and maybe you'll have some fun. So 106. That's how many skyscrapers popped up around the world in 2015. It happens to be the largest number that finished construction in a single year on record. Usually it's like 20 to 30 skyscrapers, okay? And they define skyscrapers as like 100 stories. I mean, you know, you were talking about monstrous buildings. And did you know there was a council on tall buildings and urban habitat? I mean, there's something for everybody, isn't there? There's no shortage. You can find any group on anything from, you know, fairy dust to skyscrapers if you look hard enough. So, by the way, this happens to be a Harry Dent theory, one of his theories, and he's a pretty good economist. But I was still kind of amused. So the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, they expect 135 skyscrapers to be finished in 2016 and another 140 in 2017. Remember, you don't just start a skyscraper in March and it's done in September. I mean, this is anywhere from a 1.5 to 5 year construction project. So all these buildings were started in the last several years. This is their expected completion. By the way, do you know who was number one in skyscraper construction? China. And do we know which country has the biggest meltdown going, particularly relative to its economy right now? China. There is a little correlation there. Okay, so, and by the way, as some sidelights, the tallest building in the world is the Burj Khalifa, the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. It is 2,717 feet high. That's a half a mile high, folks. Right? A half a mile. A half a mile is like 2,500 and a few feet. This building stands a half a mile high. That's impressive. It was completed in 2010. The second highest is the Shanghai Tower in China. 2,073 feet. Oh, those slackers, they're not even at a half a mile. Okay, well, China but has plans to complete another project because they don't want to be outdone, you know. The Phoenix Towers. It's in Wuhan, south central China. The tallest, this will be the tallest. It'll stand 1 kilometer high. 1 kilometer. A click, as we call it. 0.6 miles. 3,280 feet high. And by the way, you can't make this up. It's going to be pink. That is the color of this building, which is now under construction. Okay. Maybe she'd build in San Francisco. Who knows? So, Saudi Arabia, they're building a 3,280-foot tower. They call it the Kingdom Tower, by the way. That's supposed to be done by 2019. All right. So here, those are all, you know, kind of interesting tidbits, particularly the 1 kilometer pink tower. It kind of caught my fancy there. However, okay, 62 of the 106 that were completed last year, that's like 58%, were in China. Once again, the economy in the most trouble, particularly relative to its importance and size. The next highest was Indonesia with 9. They're having problems over there too, particularly with their currency. The United Arab Emirates at 7. You know, they used to have more money than God, but with oil down, all those countries are running into problems, budgetary. And Russia with 4. And Russia, as we know, is an economic wreck, partially because of Western sanctions, although I'm not sure Barry really intended that to happen, and partially because Russia is Russia, and they're really kind of a single-horse pony. It's called fossil fuels. Fossil fuels don't do well. Russia's not going to do well. It's really that simple. Okay. Do you know when the last peak, you know when the last peak of of buildings were? The last peak of buildings, you know, the largest peak was in the 1920s. And we're talking about, you know, there was like 10 buildings. And at that time, the Empire State Building was built in that time, 1,000 feet high. I mean, those are big buildings. So that the last huge boom, once again, relative to the world's economy at that time, was in the 1920s and 30s. Literally right before the Great Depression. There have been peaks, smaller peaks, and smaller busts in skyscraper construction throughout the years from 1930 to now. And however, in every single relatively major recession, the recession of 1976, which began with Jimmy Carter and kind of peaked in 1982, before Reagan got it under control, the dot-com bubble in 2000, the 87 bust, if you remember the big stock market fall in October 87, the 2007-2008 bust, which of course is very recent memory, were all preceded by peaks in skyscraper construction. It kind of makes sense. They're kind of a lagging indicator. When times are good, money is cheap, up go the buildings. The buildings are still under construction. They peak out because everybody's trying to outdo everybody else. And it is that kind of wild economic frenzy which leads to the economic collapse. My point is here is that there is some correlation in the ebb and flow of skyscraper construction for the last 100 years. And the peaks always precede bad economic times. And the country which had built the most had the worst time. That seems to be bearing out right now with China. And the country that built the least has the least rough economic times, relatively speaking, in world speak. And by the way, that happens to be us, the United States, because we only built 2 last year. So there's some good news here. The silver lining in every cloud. Anyway, I think it's all quite interesting. The top 10 countries, by the way, for skyscraper construction here in the last few years was China. I mean, just like by heads and tails, 60 plus. Indonesia with 9. The United Arab Emirates with between 5 and 10. Russia with its 4. South Korea with 2, with 3. Malaysia with 2. Mexico with 2. Panama with 2. And the United States with 2. So I think kind of an interesting little side light there for you guys, don't you think? Now, here's one which will make your eyes cross. I mean, let's face it, the majority of my listeners, maybe they don't think exactly like I do. That would be a scary thing. But shall we say that you at least have polite patience with my theories, ideas, dots, and the news that I bring you that nobody else does. And then, of course, the 10% or 20%, whatever it is, of my listeners who are liberal. You're nice people. It's tough for you to connect A to B because it's just difficult. You think differently than conservatives, but you mean well. And then I suppose there's a few percentage of you who are progressives. You know what I think of progressives. And, you know, if you want to stop listening to me, that's just fine. On the other hand, if you'd like to keep listening, that's even better. I doubt I will ever change your mind. But, you know, sometimes when I tell you that 2 plus 2 is 4 and it turns out to be 4, maybe I can just drive a little wedge in that anti-American. I'll just leave it at that. In that anti-American feeling which fills your breast every morning when you wake up and take your first breath of the day. So, and by the way, I'm sure you particular folks that I'm talking to right now are just avid supporters of, you know, nobody should have guns. Only the government can be trusted. If something goes wrong, dial 911 because that'll save you. And the government is here to help us and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that is an opinion that's, of course, held by Barry. Mr. Barack Obama, the commander-in-chief. I think it's the commander-in-chief of ISIS, actually, or Al-Qaeda. I'm not sure he's really our commander-in-chief. But nonetheless, the commander-in-chief, that's what the press calls him, so it must be so. So, you know, he obviously hates guns. He hates those bitter clingers who have guns. He has said so in his own words. And he thinks that nobody basically should have a gun other than Eric Holder, who can spread them out amongst the border and then hide the documents concerning same, and escaped a contempt of Congress citation because Congress has no cojones. So we know where Barry stands on guns. However, here's the rest of the story. From the time he was in the Illinois General Assembly, this is going back a while, and where he was, you know, now he lies about what he thinks about the Second Amendment, and this ties into the Scalia thoughts in the last two-thirds of this show. He lies about it. I'm not taking your guns, and nobody's taking your guns, and I believe in the Second Amendment, and I believe in the Constitution. Yeah, okay. Whatever you say, dude. But from the days he was in the General Assembly, was state legislature, legislator in Illinois, Mr. Obama has had up to $100,000 of his funds, him and Michelle's funds, invested in a $16 billion state pension plan, which he controls, by the way. I mean, he controls his investment, not the plan. And guess what? That plan is invested rather heavily, millions of dollars, in guns and ammo manufacturers. I mean, you really can't make this up, right? And this particular pension, retirement plan, whatever you want to call it, they hold stake in another mutual fund which owns $9.5 million worth of shares in Smith and Wesson. So, you know, Barry can tell us about how bad guns are, but Barry sure owns guns and ammo stock and is planning to retire on it. I mean, it really does kind of make you wretch, does it not? And now we're going to go to the next quick subject. I'm not sure you're going to like this one much. Your kids are going to really hate it. They're not going to like you much for it either. That's right. Your kids will hate it and not like you much. Mom and Dad, you're fired, as Mr. Trump would say. This is huge. All right. So, this month, February, congratulations to all of us. The national debt surpassed $19 trillion. Do you know what that equals for every taxpayer? Now, that's only about 50% of us anymore because we're supporting the other 50% of deadbeats. But do you know what that means for every taxpayer? That means $158,836. That's right. That $19 trillion, that's not some far-off number out there, folks. That is $158,800 that you owe. It's your share of the debt. In this big old partnership called America, that's your partner's share. Now, I don't know how much you make in a year. I would imagine I have people listening to me and the hundreds of thousands that listen to me over the course of the show. I'm sure some, you know, maybe make nothing. I'm sure some may be on some type of entitlement. And I'm not talking about Social Security where you paid in and you own it. I'm talking about an entitlement, a real entitlement, where money is printed so that you can get a check. And then some of you may be working at lower-paying jobs. Some of you may be, you know, true middle-income, blue-collar folks. I know I have a lot of listeners in that ilk. Some of you may be executives. I know I have listeners in that ilk. Whatever you are, if you are a taxpayer, your share, this is $158,000. You can figure out what that means in terms of how many years' salary, depending upon where you are, what economic rung of the economic ladder you happen to inhabit right now. And I don't think you'll like the answer when you do the math. But that's not all, folks. There's more to the story. The unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare, don't believe for one moment, by the way, that these programs are going to go broke in 2030 or 2040 or whatever crap they're feeding us now. These programs are broke right now. They're done. They're out of money. It's all been robbed. There's no trust fund. It's been put into the general fund. It's been used to balance budgets. You know, back there where Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton thumped themselves on the chest about balancing the budget. On one hand, they did a pretty damn good job, better than anybody's done in decades either side. On the other hand, here's what they didn't tell you. There was like $250 billion of that, which was taken from the Social Security Trust Fund. They left an IOU in the box. And that's how they balanced the budget and created a surplus. Bill doesn't tell you about that when he's out stumping for Hillary right now. But these are part, Social Security and Medicare are part of the unfunded liabilities. I've done shows on this. If you type unfunded liabilities in the search box, you'll get four or five shows, interviews, etc. I've been screaming about this up and down since I started this show 4 years ago. So you listeners that date all the way back to then, when there was, I don't know, five people listening to me or whatever, you've heard of this. But just Social Security and Medicare, as of this month, are underwater by $101 trillion. Just project it out. Take the population of the United States, what they're entitled to, based on these laws, the medical expenses, et cetera. It's $101 trillion as of this month. You know what that equals per taxpayer? $844,300 per taxpayer. That would be you, and that would be me. Congratulations. Divide your annual salary into that. You partner in the United States partnership, you. And then if you want to add these together and feel really good and proudly thump yourself on the chest as you tell your kids, if you add them together, it's more than $1 million. So you know when you do your financial statement for the bank, you know Dave Ramsey, who's an interesting guy to listen to, when Dave Ramsey thumps his chest along with his listeners and they have that debt-free scream, well, sorry to tell you about this, but you're not debt-free. I'm not debt-free! No, you owe $1 million. And you do owe it. Because where many of your basic services come from in this ever-growing spider of government, spider web of government, that's what you're a partner in. And your share of the partnership debt, which you're going to have to pay on those 1040 forms, and your kids, and your kids' kids, and your kids' kids' kids, given these numbers, is over $1 million. About $1,020,000, give or take. And going up every day, by the way. Congratulations to us. This is like the gift that keeps on giving. And of course, all this is made possible by Barack Obama, who on one hand slaps himself on the back with this incredible lie that that some of the media actually believe, and that all his Kool-Aid drinking followers believe with their eyes wide. It's just, it's unbelievable that they believe it. He boasts about how he cut the annual deficit. That's not the national debt. The deficit is the annual imbalance between spending and revenues in the government's budget. That he cut the annual deficit by 2/3. He forgot to tell you. When he took office, I'm going to just recap some figures for you. You old-time listeners, you've heard this. So when George Bush left office, who, by the way, did a terrible job on this. He added $5 trillion of debt to the total before. Think about this. All the presidents from George Washington up to George Bush had amassed $5 trillion, round numbers, in debt. George Bush, in his 8 years, amassed $5 trillion in debt, as much as all the other presidents put together. Now, we come to Barry. Barry has amassed twice the debt of all the presidents before him, including George Bush's $5 trillion. Now, you know, maybe some people think it's incompetent. Maybe some people think it's a mistake. It's all intentional, folks, because debt is a burden. And you always burden a beast you wish to gore. All right. By the way, I lapsed on those numbers. So when Barry took office, the annual deficit was $456 billion, give or take a few billion. Barry increased those deficits to $1.1 trillion, $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion. And now he has it down to about 500, I'm rounding numbers, 500 billion, which is where he gets this manufactured statistic that he cut the deficit 2/3. He forgot to tell you, he increased the deficit by 300% before he cut it by 2/3. And today, the deficit is still higher by about 20%, 25%, than the largest deficit run by George Bush. Which makes sense, since Barry's added $10 trillion in debt, Bush added $5 trillion, and our other 42 presidents before him totaled $5 trillion. Okay. Now, if your kids are still talking to you in the morning, I hope so, because this is not good news to tell them. I'm paying for your college, and when you get out, you owe $1 million. Congratulations, kiddo. I'm glad I could do such a wonderful job for you.